Talk number one, stewardship and culture, achievement, productivity, and rugged individualism. Welcome to Ecumenical Stewardship Center's course on stewardship and culture. I am Betsy Schwartzentraub, your instructor. First, let me introduce myself. I am a United Methodist minister, former director of stewardship for the General Board of Discipleship of the United Methodist Church, and for the California-Nevada United Methodist Foundation and Annual Conference. I've written two books, A Fire with God, Becoming Spirited Stewards, and the United Methodist Guidelines booklet, Stewardship, Nurturing Generous Living, and am working on a third called Growing a Generous Soul. I am delighted to serve on the Ecumenical Stewardship Center's resource editorial team and have a lifelong passion for intentional, joyful stewardship. This first presentation invites us to engage and critique the cultures in which we live and work, both within our church and in our specific communities and society. The Ecumenical Stewardship Center identifies four practices of faithful stewards related to our culture. First, they embrace God's vision of sufficiency, or contentment with what is enough. Second, they are able to frame insightful questions about how God is at work in specific contexts. Third, they recognize where our personal and communal choices impact the health of creation. And fourth, they demonstrate a concern for justice and sufficient sustainable living. This course includes four presentations for you to watch and listen to, hopefully by Wednesday night, each of these 4 weeks. It also expects you to do some reading. The basic text is Christine Rausch's little book, Swimming Upstream, Reflecting on Culture and Consumerism, as well as some selected articles from my site, generousstewards.wordpress.com. These are required if you want approved continuing education unit credits for the course. If you want to read further or use other resources to lead a study in your church, for example, I've recommended portions of three other books: Adam Hamilton's Enough, my book, A Fire with God, and Lynn Miller's The Power of Enough. Then, in response to the talks and reading, you'll go online to the class forum section of the transformingthechurch.org site and answer some questions based on your own considerable experience and insights. I've put up some initial questions to get us started, and you're strongly encouraged to reply to one another's comments as well, so we can follow the threads together. I will participate with you so we all can have an ongoing dialogue. In addition, we'll hold three conference calls to touch base with one another. The first took place a week before this course began. The last one will happen on the Saturday after the class closes, and one will happen midway through the course to check in and make sure we're on track with one another. See the course syllabus for the specific dates and times. This first talk looks at our cultures related to achievement, productivity, and rugged individualism. But before that, what do we mean by culture? The term culture can have a variety of meanings. The dictionary defines it in two ways. One is as the integrated pattern of human knowledge, belief, and behavior that depends on our capacity for learning and transmitting knowledge. The other description is the customary beliefs, social forms, and material traits of a racial, religious, or social group. Edward Hall puts it this way: culture is the means by which we express our identities and establish important matters of social belonging and difference. Culture primarily involves meaning and social conventions, the structures of significance that shape our thoughts and actions. In other words, a culture can include both visible things, such as individual and group behaviors and social ways of relating, and also things underneath the surface, like common beliefs and a sense of identity, what makes us distinctive, and what causes us to feel we belong with one another. Our culture can involve a particular ethnicity, a nationality, an age group, a social setting, or an economic level, a whole bunch of different things. It can also refer to a congregation. So in a sense, all of us who participate in a church are part of both an inward culture and an outward culture. The outward culture includes the external community where we are located, as well as the wider society in which we live, including our people and nation. The inward culture may include our congregation or primary faith community of one kind or another, and our denomination or wider faith network. Many congregations reflect a lot of the outward culture, one way or another, especially in terms of a matching socioeconomic group, common concerns and assumptions, and so forth. But some churches have intentionally developed a distinctive identity and don't automatically overlap as much. Either way, it takes intentionality to reach out to those around us. Now, I chose an iceberg as the image of culture because just as 9/10 of an iceberg is below the waterline and therefore out of sight, so 9/10 of our culture is beneath our usual awareness. The cultural aspects we're usually aware of are our conscious beliefs and values, our recreational activities, things like cooking and dress, popular music, literature and drama, and what we consider to be fine arts. But there's a whole lot more to one's culture underneath the surface. It can include our concept of the good life, our notions of worship and sense of what the spiritual leader's responsibility is to the faith community, the incentives and norms in our workplace, our concept of social power and limits to friendship, ideas about responsibility and sense of what's an appropriate relationship between leaders and followers, just to name a few. Our particular culture can involve our attitudes toward those who are dependent upon us, different views of roles according to one's occupation or class or kinship, our preference for competition or cooperation, and the way we deal with our emotions. So when we apply all that, the 9/10 underneath the water, to stewardship, it's no wonder that people have a lot of different assumptions and expectations. So what about the meaning of stewardship? Stewardship is not a cover-up word for give us your money. It is whatever we do with the good news of God's love by the way that we live in every dimension of our lives, our relationships and use of time, nourishment and exercise of our bodies, where we place our priorities, passions, and values, focus for our abilities, use of money and possessions, and the ways we care for the earth and all creatures. In other words, it's all the ways we actually live out our faith in God. Good stewardship includes multiple dimensions. For example, it can embrace stewardship of our lifestyle and of the environment, including finding a balance between work and rest, caring for the earth and other creatures, and moving towards simpler living. Use of our time, talents, and spiritual gifts, such as addressing a workaholic lifestyle, loving God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and living fruitfully by identifying and using our spiritual gifts and helping others to do the same. First fruits living, proportionate giving, and tithing. Personal and family financial management, including working out a budget, getting rid of debt, and being content with what is enough in money and possessions. Funding the church, church financial management, and interpreting our shared ministries that help people ecumenically in the interfaith efforts and through our denominations around the world. We cannot do these things just by ourselves individually. Becoming generous stewards depends upon our finding our identity within a Christian or faith community somewhere. For most of us, that's a real-life congregation. For some, it may also be an online group, a giving circle, or some other kind of network with other people. We get to know one another, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and deal with real-life situations. That's how we work out our faith in the real world. Now, productivity is a key word in Western culture. In most of our work settings and elsewhere, we are expected to be efficient and fast-paced in accomplishing the goals we choose or that are set before us. Achievement is a virtue, and accomplishment equals success. At the same time, we're encouraged to think individualistically, a remnant of the frontier mentality, as if we have come up by our own bootstraps. Like Frank Sinatra, we like to sing, "I did it my way." Of course, there are positive aspects to our desire to achieve and produce. We can get a lot of things done and be a powerful force for good in this world. We can feel good and be confident, have others look up to us, and be a model for others, helping them dream big and achieve their dreams. But there's a negative side to this emphasis as well. Our reputation is only as good as our last effort. We become what we do, and we are what we earn. We can get trapped into thinking that only what is useful counts. The useful stepping stone relationship or situation in order to get somewhere else. The service we do just to get it on our resume. The useful person for us to get what we want, not for who they are. And those whose connections are no longer publicly useful to us and to others have lost their worth. In his book, Enough, Adam Hamilton refers to a dream that turns into a nightmare. Whether we live in the U.S. or Canada, the vast majority of us in the northern Western Hemisphere have been subject to the American dream, the opportunity to go for everything and have it all. It can turn into a nightmare when we fall prey to the urging to live beyond our means. We're enticed into having it now and paying for it later. As a result, millions of us get into all kinds of trouble with money. In fact, money can act like a god in our lives. Stewardship leader Mark Vincent lists a bunch of reasons, including that money outlives us. We're tempted to worship it. It has a great circle of influence, greater circle of influence than we can have by ourselves. There's mystery associated with it and with those who have a lot of it. It mimics all that God promises about the New Jerusalem: happiness, health, dignity, peace, justice, and promises some of it now. We can convert just about everything into money if we choose to, and it can make us think that we are God, that we're in charge of everything, all-powerful, and capable of being everywhere. Our text, Swimming Upstream, talks about some of the major problems we can have with money, including keeping up with the Joneses in our buying and conspicuous consumption, often turning holidays and special events into buying binges, and getting into perennial debt, thinking we can't live without it. You've seen the bumper sticker, I owe, so off to work I go. So as Christians trying to live according to Jesus' priorities, we're swimming upstream related to all these money patterns. And this struggle over money also can give us huge problems with time. Being driven to work constantly, to stay in touch and reply electronically at every hour of the day or night, and to never know the feeling of real time off, just for being, let alone Sabbath. So what about the counterculture, what we want to strengthen in our personal lives and in the life of the church we now lead and serve? One keynote is in Psalm 46, verse 10. Be still and know that I am God. I am exalted among the nations. I am exalted in the earth. Now, this is not a call to relax and collapse because we're personally tired of the stress and tension in our lives. It's the culmination of three stanzas that proclaim God's sovereignty. First stanza, over the raging of nature with the sea symbolizing every form of chaos. Second stanza, over the assaults of all the nations who have ever stormed the walls of Jerusalem. And third stanza, over all the battlefields of human history, in all their wreckage, acknowledging that God's eternal reign gives peace on earth. This is a triumphant statement that since God is sovereign over all the world and all time, we will not be afraid. At first blush, it may seem a little too cosmic for a congregation or a denomination, but as Christian stewards, we stand for and in a radically different culture from the one in which we now live. And unless we're clear on our identity and where we truly reside, we'll end up engulfed in the secular, materialistic culture, just trying to tweak its money and action addiction. I'll get congregation-specific in a moment, but we need to touch base with one other Bible passage, Romans 12, verse 2. Here Paul says, "Do not be conformed to this world or age, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect or mature. We are not merely trying to maintain our lives or manage the church. We are here to be channels for God's transformation of human beings through the work of the church. So as we take on growing authentic stewards in the midst of a contrary culture, we need to know not only who we are, but also whose we are as ambassadors for Christ in a foreign land. So now to some particular goals or processes we can focus on as we think about our churches. In a multi-year study of the congregations in the United Church of Canada, researcher Barbara Fullerton discovered 6 best stewardship practices. After all, if we don't know where we want to go, how in the world can we get there? The first is operational management, including mission clarity, a narrative budget, an annual giving program, donor appreciation, sound fundraising methods, and multiple opportunities for financial giving. Second, integration of stewardship in worship, using stewardship worship resources in worship planning, preaching stewardship almost every week, nurturing young stewards through children's messages, and celebrating the offering as an act of worship. Third, stewardship formation that creates a culture of gratitude and generosity, including stewardship education with youth and adults through classes, confirmation, vacation Bible school, Bible study in small groups, legacy giving seminars, and personal finance training. Fourth, experiencing stewardship leadership by both clergy and laity through involvement in wider church roles and stewardship training. Fifth, providing opportunities for spiritual nurture through Bible study and small group ministries, and encouraging a shift of our self-image from that of consumers to stewards. Sixth, engaged in social justice concerns that reveal a clear congregational DNA and mission as the basis for an effective stewardship strategy, resulting in community outreach opportunities. In the book Growing Up Generous, the writers report on studies of giving and serving among youth and adults that found 9 factors that predict personal generosity. As you hear these, you might think of your own experiences and which of these may have affected you, leading you to learn more about joyous stewardship. Experiencing the generosity of others and receiving care from parents and other significant adults. Spending time in home, church, or school settings where caring and generosity are invited and respected. Being guided by religious beliefs that encourage care, compassion, and generosity. Interacting with mentors and role models who both practice and teach generosity. Having concrete opportunities to serve and give, and being personally invited to participate. Experiencing a faith that is alive, deep, dynamic, life-shaping. Finding enjoyment and fulfillment through acts of giving and serving. Being connected to people from diverse backgrounds and who have a unique awareness of issues in the world. Possessing self-confidence and a belief in one's own capacity to make a difference. This leads us to ask ourselves, as a congregation or a denomination, how do we prompt these factors to be felt in people's lives? Well, we build a plan for growing great stewardship and generosity. Over these 4 weeks, you'll have an opportunity to design a plan for creating or strengthening a strong culture of generosity in your church. 2 worksheets in the Generous Stewards site will help you write down the key elements, note what you're already doing, and identify where you want to go. Meantime, here is your assignment for this week. Read Rausch's Swimming Upstream, pages 41 through 66, and 75 through 81, and from generousstewards.wordpress.com, these articles: 6 Best Stewardship Practices, Growing Generosity, Vital Signs, 'Tis the Season, and Factors That Predict Generosity. They're short pieces. I also recommend pages 9 to 28 in Adam Hamilton's book Enough that talks about our dreams turning into nightmares. So these are the starter questions. 1. Given the iceberg model of a culture, how would you describe the internal culture of your church? In what ways does it reflect an outward culture, community or society, of achievement, productivity, or rugged individualism? In what ways is it counter-cultural? 2. As you consider your faith community, what is the right balance of achievement, programs, or effectiveness on the one hand, and trusting God's sovereignty and resting in God on the other? Is it possible to be both and not either or in this? When do you sense you're getting to the tipping point? 3. Of the 6 best practices discovered in the Canadian study of local churches, which one seems strongest in your church? Which one is the greatest challenge? What about in your wider outward community? 4. What elements might be part of a plan for your congregation to build a more vibrant culture of generosity? 5. What are the most important things in life for you? Make a list. How does money affect each of these, positively or negatively? 6. Comment on one idea from this presentation that captured your attention. Thank you. I'll talk with you further online.